Hello and welcome to the as yet unnamed London Theatre Podcast for the 11th of October 2015. My name's TRP Watson, and this week I'm joined by Tim from Civilian Theatre, Gareth James, Phil from the Western Whingers, and Johnny Fox. We're now going to talk about Medea, which is the last play of the Almeida Greeks season. This is a new version of Euripides' play by Rachel Cusk, and directed by Rupert Gould, and starring Kate Fleetwood. It also features Michelle Austin, Amanda Boxer, Richard Kant, Andy De La Tour, Charlotte Randall, Justin Salinger, and a number of others. Rupert Gould, of course, used to be artistic director of Headlong, and there's still a lot of relationship between them, and I've been racking my brains trying to remember the last time Headlong did a Medea, and it was in 2012, where Mike Bartlett wrote and directed an adaptation, like this modern dress adaptation, for Rachel Sterling, which toured around. I don't think it got further into London than the Watford Playhouse, but it was an interesting take on it, and a much more domestic take than this one. This one has a certain domesticity, but you still feel that we have a powerful dynasty. I think the previous version, she was more of a fairly ordinary housewife in the Mike Bartlett version. But this one, I think, retains some of the regal elements to it, or at least it felt that to me. So, Tim, what did you think about this play? And tell me more about it.
For me, this play does kind of teeter on both the edge of brilliance, as much as Medea sort of teeters throughout on the edge of madness. As you say, it's the third play of the Almeida Greeks series of tragedies following Oresteia and Bacchae. And as you also point out, in comparison to those two plays, it is much more of a domestic tragedy. I think for anyone going to see it, the most important thing to realise is that you will not be going to see an ancient Greek play as you might traditionally expect an ancient Greek play to look like. Whereas both Oresteia and most certainly Bacchae had the feel of things which could have been set thousands of years ago, I feel that you could go and watch Medea and perhaps not even realise that you're watching an ancient play. For some people, that may be a little bit of a problem, but I think it's entirely right to ensure that Medea actually works within a modern context. There has been some criticism, I think, of how far it has moved away from the original plotting, but I think my challenge back would be that this is kind of what storytelling has always done. It has always taken these kind of old myths and reworked them and reframed them for the modern world. And I think in Rachel Cusk's hands, it has resolved what is often a kind of a real problem, a real conundrum at the heart of the Medea story for when you do try and update it to the modern age. Because Medea is always talked about as a great play, but fundamentally, there's a challenge for any modern version, which is that the action which Medea eventually takes can never really justify or be justified within the context of a play. She is certainly a wronged woman, but it never then leads on to the fact that you can justify the fact that she eventually commits the act of filicide. In this updated version, Rachel Cusk works around that by tweaking the ending, by reframing the narrative slightly. And I think there will be people who don't like that, and I think that is okay. It does change the nature and the tone of Euripides' original play slightly. But for me, I really felt it gave Medea the freedom to allow the audience to think that maybe that there was some sort of slight hope that she could be morally absolved by the end of it, and that her actions weren't directly responsible for the potential death of her children. Now, at the centre of this play are two absolutely blistering performances by Kate Fleetwood as Medea and Justin Salinger as Jason. And between them, they have the most violent, bitter and snarling arguments I think I have ever seen on the London stage. It's a portrait of the most terrible kind of marital breakdown, and it really is expertly handled in a way which makes you realise just how unusual it is to see these kind of completely emotionally draining, devastating battles take place in most drama you see on stage. And that's all to do with the quality of the acting on stage and the way that Cusk and Gould have allowed the actors the freedom to effectively shout over the top of one another. I mean, when you see arguments take place on stage normally, usually for the sake of coherence and clarity for the audience, one actor speaks, then another actor speaks, then the first actor speaks, and then the other actor responds. And that obviously makes a lot of sense, but it isn't really very realistic in terms of when people actually do have these real emotional fights with one another, where they are messy, they are incoherent, they are hard to follow. And so often there's a certain sense of unreality to it. But here, Fleetwood and Salinger manage to talk almost and shout often, almost continuously over one another. And yet, from my perspective, from the audience's point of view, the dialogue still comes through clearly enough that you get both the language of the text, but also the real painful, devastating nature of the argument. I think Kate Fleetwood is just exceptional as Medea. She is very, very good at these kind of complex, ambiguous, like emotionally drained characters. I think the first thing I saw her in was as Lady Macbeth in Rupert Gould's production of Macbeth a few years ago now. And Medea just seems such a natural kind of transition that she just sort of seeps seamlessly into the part, and she has a very kind of flinty, steely feel to her, which gives her a real sense of kind of emotional numbness. And her stillness on the stage is really gives her a captivating presence. And equally, Justin Salinger as Jason, as this kind of preening actor type who just does not begin to realize his complete self-absorption, and he has this kind of charmed life which he clearly believes is something which he has done to himself rather than has been done to him. And so when he acts with what he sees as complete reasonableness, he has such a lack of empathy that he feels that he is totally unable to kind of realize that all he is doing is just trying to manage the situation so that it ends the way that he wants it to end. And it's very, very easy to kind of get on the side of Medea, despite the fact that she is also in some ways kind of partly to blame by just refusing to enter and reconcile with the process. And the last thing I think I'd like to touch on is the fact that there are some very subtle and clever nods towards the original in Cusk's version. I think something which can often be lost in the ancient version is the sense that Medea is seen as a barbarian compared to the people of Corinth where she is taken. And here Cusk nods to this by having these kind of chorus of middle-class Islington-set women with their babies. And whilst it's always left broadly unsaid that there's this class divide, there's just a few comments here and there about her not being one of them, and a wonderfully kind of tart sequence around the issue of Medea's child biting one of the children of the other parents, which really says so much more than kind of pages of dialogue. ever could. So for me, this was, I think, a very strong production, which rounds off in style the whole Almeida Greeks season.
So what do you think about Medea, Gareth?
Well, I think I'm less enthusiastic about it than Tim. I mean, there is a lot to admire in it. It is a very radical and a very inventive interpretation. But I had a couple of problems with it, really. And the first of the problems was the adaptation by Rachel Cusk, because I felt that it was too autobiographical, I suppose, really. I mean, her Medea is a writer like her, and her Medea is in the middle of a messy divorce like hers, it seems. And I think she's kind of ruined it a bit by making it too self-indulgent, I would say, and because of these seemingly autobiographical elements and changing the story to kind of fit her experiences, perhaps. You know, it is by and large faithful to the story. He's traded in Medea for a younger model. We don't actually meet her on this occasion, but we do meet her dad. And the chorus on this occasion are these kind of slowly yummy mummies, which I actually quite liked. I thought that was quite clever. And it starts very well with a brilliant scene with the mum and dad, who are sort of spouting lots of I told you so stuff, as only mum and dads can do, really. So there was lots I liked about it, but it was that autobiographical bit, plus this quite dramatic change of ending, which is to some extent, I mean, which fits her adaptation, but isn't faithful enough to Euripides. So it becomes, if you like, her play rather than an adaptation of a Greek tragedy. And I think that it just moves too far away from the story of Medea, and I think that's its fatal flaw, frankly. And this ending is, I mean, I won't say any more about it because I think that would probably spoil it. This ending for me kind of ruined it. So I was going really well for quite a long time with the play until, you know, the autobiographical bit was a niggle, I guess. And then when it got to the final kind of hurdle, to me it just fell apart. And that was greatly disappointing, because I felt there was a lot to like about it. And of the three Almeida Greek plays, this is the weaker of the three for me. And I think that is very much down to the adaptation rather than the performances or the staging, which were really excellent. So I'm afraid I left a bit disappointed. I kind of left thinking that was a shame. And I wondered whether Rupert Gould had, you know, whether he should have allowed that to happen. What did you think, Tim?
I enjoyed it for what it was, and I did enjoy the updating of it. I wasn't quite so aware as you of the autobiographical elements, but I just see how well it worked, I think, as a play, as a retelling of it. I mentioned before the one that Headlong did with, done by Mike Bartlett, starring Rachel Sterling, which I was trying to remember what that was like, because it was a similar modernization and a similar setup, and it seems to have gone out of my head, which is a bit annoying, because I thought I couldn't remember if it was better, or, you know, whether it was better or not. But I thought this was very, very strong, and I did think things like the chorus worked very well, and it kind of worked well, and I think it worked better than the one they did at the National overall. But yeah, I can see what you mean. If it is too autobiographical, it doesn't quite work, and there is that idea of that it's been too changed, it's not as visceral and not bloody enough, and I didn't really think that simply writing a book about somebody would be enough to really change matters. I mean, you do want the blood, you do want the viciousness, even if it's just her killing off Jason's new bride, or injuring Jason's new bride. She doesn't have to necessarily kill the children, but sort of a soft touch for something where we've had a bloody time of it in a good way over the other two plays in this season.
I mean, I thought that the National's Medea with Helen McCrory was much, much, much better and much, much, much more faithful to the Euripides play. And I actually thought, even though that had a radical ending from memory, I think the house burnt down or something, I think that the Headlong one that Mike Bartlett adapted was also a better adaptation. So for me, both of them were better than this. Because, I mean, what you have to remember at the end of the day is that, you know, you're not writing a new play, you're adapting a play. I mean, it's perfectly valid to write a new play. If you wanted to write a new play inspired by Medea, that's absolutely fine. But actually, this is an adaptation of Euripides' play. And on that level, it doesn't work for me, because it varies too far from Euripides' original. So that's my take on it. And that's why it doesn't work as well as the National or the Headlong production, which were radical, but still were faithful enough to Euripides to be Euripides' Medea adapted by whoever adapted them.
We're now going to talk about Showstopper, which is at the Apollo Theatre. Showstopper is the improvised musical and is improvised by a team of actor, singer, dancers who put a new show together every night. So they are promising over their 10-week run 80 new musicals put together. I have to say, I've seen quite a lot of improvisation over the years, especially things that, like the Comedy Store Players, we started seeing about 20, 25 years ago. And you have people like Josie Lawrence and Richard Varange, who were the sort of the resident song improvisers there. Yeah, you can see how it's done, and it's a fascinating process. Phil, tell me more about this show and what do you think about this process in general?
This show's been kicking around for a long time. I saw a matinee a couple of weeks ago on a Sunday afternoon, and that was show 617. It's been in London before, not in a full sort of West End residency. It sort of popped up at late performances, and it's been at Edinburgh a lot. And you know, every night, as you say, they create a show sort of on the hoof. And actually, in the case of when I saw it, it was on the trot, because themes are suggested by the audience. One of the cast, the night I saw it, it might be every night, I'm not sure, Dylan Emery, who's one of the co-founders of Showstopper, sort of introduces the show, and the premise is he's on the phone to Cameron Mackintosh pitching a new musical, which is sort of made up on the spot. And it's made up partly by the audience, who are invited to suggest a setting for it, first of all, and then various ones are shouted out and voted on, then a title, and then various styles of song or musicals, which they will then perform the numbers in. And then after the interval, themes or things are tweeted to the show, which are then chosen again by the audience. And it's incredibly enjoyable, and it's just amazing how they actually do it. The one that I saw was called Swill, which was set in a pig farm in Dorset, and it was a sort of a love story, the boy going off to university and finding a new love, and then they got back together again. But you can't do a spoiler on this, because every night will be different, and I believe on the opening night it was in the offices of the Daily Mail, which I think would be hilarious. I can talk about the show I saw, but you won't see that. The styles of songs were suggested in the style of Oklahoma, Phantom of the Opera, Cats, The Mikado, Annie, Grease, Company, and then Eric Clapton, all of which you really got the feeling of those styles of musical. And they even had a number, when I saw it, set on Clifton Suspension Bridge, with all the finger clicking going on, and they managed, and they're improvising the words as they go along, they managed to shoehorn the name Isambard Kingdom Brunel into it and make it rhyme and scan, which I find quite astonishing. I mean, obviously there is a sort of a structure, which is every now and again the MC stops the show and will tell them to do a song in the style of that, but it actually doesn't spoil the story, and it actually I kind of believed in the story they were telling. And given that some musicals are years gestating, and they're doing it, and they're coming up with a quite reasonable story, and numbers, the show closed with a number called Where the Swirl Was Away, which I came out humming at the end, which is more than I can say for a lot of new shows. So I just don't really know how they do it. And you kind of are watching them quite closely, and you can sort of see them concentrating on what they're going to do, and yet it doesn't spoil it. Sometimes they just appear to be just doing it out of nowhere, and how they actually, when they're doing dialogue, know when to stop and let the other one speak is quite incredible. The show that I saw, I thought particularly outstanding, was Ruth Bratt and Pippa Evans, who played the two female leads in it. Ruth Bratt had a great running gag. She was sort of a married Dorset woman with loads of children, and was kind of rubbing it into the girl who didn't even have a boyfriend how many children she got and how happy she was at home. And it was just hilarious. I mean, it's a show that you could go and see several times. I'm quite tempted to go again and just see what you get. I'm glad it's having a West End run, a proper West End run. I wouldn't be surprised if it does well, but it extends. The prices, I think, are quite high for this sort of a show. They're up to £65 for premium seats, but there's lots of offers around. So I'd sort of pay £20 or £30 to see it, but I wouldn't pay £65, even though it's very, very good, because I'd like to see several versions of it to see how different it is and almost work out how they do it. The programme actually has a thing that actually a lot of people think there's huge conspiracy theories that they're being fed things. and they list all the conspiracy theories in the program, but they're clearly not. They are just making up as they go along. And I found it very, very enjoyable. And I don't even think you have to particularly like musicals. You kind of need to know the musical styles, but even if you don't know musicals very well, you'll know the ones that they do because they tend to go with the well-known ones. So yeah, I think it's great. Really, really enjoyable. And I think, Tim, you know, you should go and see it actually at some point.
Yeah, maybe. I mean, one of the things about improvisation is that if you watch it a lot of times, you do tend to see what they aim towards and what they want to do. And I think that your point about the structure, I mean, that's one of the things they can hang on to, because if they have very strong structures in mind when they're doing this, and I don't think, I wouldn't believe in the conspiracy theories myself, because I've seen enough improvisation to know that a good improviser can improvise almost anything. In fact, I think I won a prize once at the Comedy Store when they were improvising, when I suggested they were in a paper cup on the North Sea. So we got a scene and a paper cup on the North Sea, and it was improvised very well. So that kind of improvisation, if they know what they're doing, and they do seem to have been around, as you say, for a long time, so it does look as if they kind of know how to gel together, and they kind of know how to improvise. It does sound rather impressive, I have to say, so it might be worth a visit at some point.
Also, it's a rotating cast, so I'm not sure how many there are, but you get sort of seven per performance out of a cast of, I think it's maybe, is the list about 12 people or something like that? And one particular thing, I mean, I think it was the little touch as well that I really enjoyed, because ours was set on a pig farm, and there was a scene in an abattoir, and there's no real scenery to speak of. There's a few sort of frames which can be wheeled around, and they are used to suggest locations. You know, they suggested Clifton Suspension Bridge, but they also sort of wheeled on one, and one of the cast just then sort of hung from it like a sort of carcass in the abattoir, and then the others sort of followed suit, hanging like carcasses. Just little touches of that were hilarious. I think I will have to go and see it again.
We're now going to talk about Teddy Ferrara, which is on at the Donmar Warehouse. This is a play by Christopher Shin, inspired is the wrong word, so I'll say based on the suicide of a young American student at Rutgers University called Tyler Clementi, who was filmed in his dorm room kissing another man, and as a result threw himself off a bridge, George Washington Bridge, which is one that goes from New Jersey to New York. John, tell me more about this play and what you thought of it.
I found it struck a chord with me because I did know the story of young Tyler Clementi. He was only 18. He was a freshman at Rutgers University and was possibly one of the first high-profile cases of homosexual bullying that kind of came to public notice in America, other than, for example, the young man who was chained to a fence in Wyoming and unfortunately was left to die by people who were deliberately brutalizing him. This is far more subtle, if you like, that the kind of bullying wasn't even taunting. It was that he was secretly filmed having sex with a male lover, and his roommate broadcast it on the internet. And unfortunately, even though it was proven that he had been doing this and inviting lots of other people through Facebook and Twitter to watch the broadcast, New Jersey's hate crime laws were framed in such a strange way, and in fact were reframed following this case between the event and the trial, were rewritten, but done so badly that the offender actually only served 20 days of a sentence for effectively causing a suicide. And this sort of hit home with me because this happened 5 years ago, but 40 years ago, I was a student at Lancaster University, which, at least as far as the anecdotal evidence on the internet goes, is the suicide capital of the British education system. A factor not helped by the fact that the centre of the campus is a 14-storey tower block with open balconies. And there were several plummetings during my 3 years there. So this is not a new issue that students, for one reason or another, might jump to their deaths. And in fact, one of the things I didn't like about Teddy Ferrara was it didn't seem apart from the fact that the students used their mobile phones all the time, it didn't seem terribly contemporary. Because the way it's conducted and the way the discussion about what has happened and what might happen to somebody else is progressed is through a series of committee meetings convened by the university president and a woman senior academic figure or senior administrative figure called the provost. And the students they invite to the meeting. And unfortunately, what Christopher Shin has done, and in a way, he is kind of making the mistake that he's inviting people not to make, which is to categorize and tokenize and identify people by types. Two of the very best performances in this piece are an actor playing a trans character and an actor playing a character in a wheelchair. Both of whom are actually people of those categories, and their performances are immaculate. But unfortunately, the way they are used in the play is not immaculate, and it's not culturally insensitive, it's not wrong, it's just a bit too tokenist. And it's by identifying people by their attributes or their disabilities that such, if you like, humiliation by one group of people to another or one individual to another can occur. And I felt that Christopher Shin had perhaps fallen into his own trap there. But it is, as I say, a series of meetings in meeting rooms and collisions of two people in a corridor, and a lot of scenes start with, oh, hi, it's you. And it's almost as bad as The Archers, really, that the characters keep re-identifying who they are and why they have to talk to each other. And I felt it was overlong. It's 2 hours and 40 minutes with an interval, but even so, it was a long 2 hours and 40 minutes. And although I was absorbed by the subject matter, I thought it was wordy. I mean, it's really, really talky. And a lot of the events, you know, are very static. Having said that, there are some extremely good performances. I would pick out Nancy Crane, who plays the provost, who has to balance the university's interests with that of this new wave of political correctness that she's obliged to apply to the staff. And her most difficult colleague, if you like, is the university president himself. Very good. Again, a very good performance by Matthew Marsh. The students, some good, some perhaps a little bit not so striking. Jack, the trans person, Griffin Gilligan, is an excellent performance. And Jay, the guy in the wheelchair, Christopher, I think it's Imbrosciano, is how you pronounce his last name, is extremely good. In fact, I saw him after the show, and he's not actually in a wheelchair, but he walks with an awkward gait, which indicates I think he might have had polio or something when he was younger. But the unaffected students, the students who are able-bodied and have recognizable lives, are also embroiled in really complicated love triangles, which, again, I didn't think was enormously plausible. Principal character, the character who is intended to draw you in and you are meant to identify with and enjoy and suffer his various experiences, Luke Newbery, plays a handsome, blonde, you know, nice-looking young man called Gabe. But he is hampered, if you like, by two other characters, one of which is a very unconvincing editor of the student newspaper, which apparently comes out daily. I've never heard of a student rag that was issued every day. And he has an agenda of his own, and he's very manipulative, and he manipulates both his girlfriend and the gay guy who works for him, who again is a little bit tokenist because he's black. I just felt that the student characters were not quite as finely drawn as they could be for a very modern production. It did feel very much like it was set in the 80s, which it's not intended to be. The production values are very good. Dominic Cook has done a great job with the staging. But there's just something missing from this, and I can't quite put my finger on what it is. The character, the main character, Teddy Ferrara, played by Ryan McParland, is deeply unlovable. And that perhaps is the cleverest thing about the piece. I don't know whether Tyler Clementi himself was in any way unengaging, but this young man is not handsome, not smart, a bit geeky, gets off and possibly makes money by masturbating to various people online in some kind of online forum. He also has canker sores on the inside of his mouth, but that doesn't stop him meeting someone and giving him a blowjob. It's all, he's just a bit skanky. And I think there's more to be played with in the way your sympathies are maybe disengaged and then re-engaged when something terrible happens to him. But I feel this could have been developed a little bit longer and a little bit better. But that's not to say that it isn't well staged and well performed and worth a look. I think most of the regular tickets are sold, so it will be a question of getting a Barclays £10 front row seat. And definitely for that, it's worth it. So, Tim, I mean, have I said everything, or is there something you felt that you disagreed with or that you'd like to add?
Well, I did think that the play was not really about Teddy Ferrara, which is a bit of a problem, because I think I was slightly more engrossed by the love triangle. You have the character Gabe, who is starting a relationship with Drew, the editor, and Drew is very interested in Gabe's best friend, who is apparently straight. And there is another previous suicide that they all talk about, which Drew not necessarily played a part in, but there's a history there. And Drew is a very interesting and very horrible character in this play. And I don't think that Christopher Shin seems to have started off wanting to do a play about that and sort of got more interested in this love triangle. You know, he wants to do a play which is more about the Tyler Clementi idea and the idea of a gay man being done with suicide. But I found that almost incidental in this play. Mm. And I didn't understand that the Teddy Ferrara here would have been any more or less unhappy by being filmed. I mean, he's already on the chat room thing or
it's a sort of website, isn't it, where people sign in to like a live sex show or something.
Yeah, and he doesn't seem to be terribly fazed by it, and you don't understand why he's doing it. And I think that's part of that's what Christopher Shin wants to do anyway, is make sure that it's a mystery why he does it. You know, you're not absolutely certain why he in the end decides to kill himself. I mean, he's obviously not a particularly happy person to start off with. But I thought what we mainly get in terms of relationships is the Gabe love triangle, which is very odd. And you have this character that I think also that Christopher Shin not necessarily fell in love with, but enjoyed, which is the character of Drew, who is complete, well, I would hesitate to say complete filth, but he's a newspaper editor, shall we say. In the best British tabloid traditions, although this is America, but that kind of idea. I mean, he's a really unpleasant character, and I think Christopher Shin was a bit too dazzled with him. There is also the thread of how the university is dealing with it, and how they want to appear to do the right thing, but not actually have to do anything at all. Like you, I was very impressed with Nancy Crane and Matthew Marsh. Matthew Marsh does seem to play an awful lot of Americans, and some people think he is American, which is a bit odd. Well, not odd that people think he's American because he plays so many Americans, but he does make a sort of a very convincing character in this president. And we do end up with a kind of a hypocritical scene, you know, the kind of the hypocrisy of that you ignore the people until they commit suicide. He's not of any interest to anybody until he commits suicide. That sort of thing happens, but I think somehow that Christopher Shin wasn't really lost interest in his main subject in the end.
Well, I think the audience might have as well by the end. There were a lot of people coming out going, well, you know, that didn't go anywhere, did it?
You can find us at AYULTP on Twitter, on the as yet unnamed London Theatre Podcast page on Facebook, on the web we are AYULTP.com. The podcast can also be found on both iTunes and Stitcher, where you can leave a review. Thank you, goodbye.